Today, we're going to approach the topic of online communication from a different angle, thinking through the propaganda strategies used by political extremists in our ever-expanding age of self-documentation and expression on the internet and social media. Some of the themes we'll be exploring are the role of social media in the mobilization of young extremists, the difference between analog and digital forms of political activism, and social media as a combined space of communicative possibility and of polarization and violence. This is Medea Vox, and today we will discuss the issue of extremist communication with our guest, Mikael Krohne, Senior Lecturer in Media and Communication Studies at Malmö University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's begin. This is a really tricky and challenging subject. So let's begin at the beginning. Could you take us back, or at least one of the beginnings, to the way things used to be in terms of how extremist groups express themselves and what shifted between analog and digital?
I think you can start by looking at pre-internet era, where you had extremist groups from different political perspectives used whatever means they could to basically, terrorism was quite hidden back then. There were attacks being made, but the communication, the internal communication of extremist groups back then were quite hidden, and it was taking place in secret post office boxes and stuff like that. What has changed with the internet has been that there has been a lot of things that has changed, but one of them is that extremist communication surrounding extremism has been more open, taking place in the open public spheres of society, and thereby also being more accepted in normalized in terms. So I think that internet really changed the way groups communicate internally and also externally. We can start with the early 1990s, where we had especially right-wing movements who they were really fast to adopt the new technology of internet in the early 90s, especially because most of the groups or that type of political view from the right-wing extremism was shut out of the traditional mass media, television, radio. So they had to, in some way, develop strategies to use the new technology to both to gain support but also to spread their message and coordinate different type of protests or whatever they were doing. So that was an important part. They also adopted quite early using electronic billboards, stuff like that, for messaging. The 90s was very dominated by a new right-wing extremism movement, especially in Sweden. The city where I grew up in the eastern parts of Sweden, that was a stronghold for right-wing extremism in the 1990s, and I can still remember it. I was young back then. I can still remember how this was if their communications were quite hidden, their protests were really out in the street with shining boots and jackets and no hair on the heads and stuff like that. So that was quite out in the open, and that was an important, I think it was an important aspect of their development, the right-wing movement development, that internet came at the early 1990s, just as there were political aspects that really helped them to grow. The fall of the Berlin Wall, for instance, and the collapse of communism. There were great political changes happening, which made right-wing extremism grow. And that technology came at the same time, and it also, I think it helped, it's speeded up their development in the 1990s. And then an important marker is 2001, the 9/11 attacks. After that, I think that the Islamist extremism have grown substantially. You can discuss the reasons for their growth and why it has been so on the political agenda after 9/11. But it grew really, really fast after 2001. And there are different circumstances affecting that development. Maybe one of them is the US retaliation after the attacks that really, as a consequence, extremism in the Middle East could really grow, and that extremism often took a very strong religious, was taken from a very strong religious foundation. So, and then that developed to what we are seeing today.
I mean, many of us can remember what we were doing, if we're old enough, in 2001 on the day that we were told the Twin Towers were hit. And but then, you know, there wasn't Facebook.
No.
And there wasn't the kinds of social networking, the Twitter, and I'm not sure about the dark net, but certainly
not developed.
The internet wasn't as sophisticated as it is now. So what were they doing then? I mean,
then they were doing. There are a few examples of if we compare to what is going on today, what ISIS and other groups are doing with, for example, public beheadings. They were being videotaped back then and sent to different type of news channels, but they were being videotaped in an analog way. And the strategies were the same. It's just that the technology were different, and the pace of distribution and reaching followers were different. But the strategies were basically the same. What has changed is mainly the pace now. The technology has been more integrated in people's everyday lives, thereby also more. The technology isn't dangerous, but it has a larger impact or a faster impact on everyday people. So. Back then, they were basically doing the same thing. It's just that we didn't really know about it that fast, and it didn't get that true media impact.
I mean, we hear the words propaganda, communication, social media, and they all have their ways of symbolically communicating to a certain kind of public. You mentioned before, for example, that back in the analog days, people would be dressed in a certain kind of way to intimidate the people that they were engaging with. How do you see symbolic communication having shifted now that we're in the realm of, you know, digital self-fashioning and selfies? And have you seen any changes?
I think the type of, as I said, the clothing and stuff like that became sort of identity markers, because a lot of groups, no matter if they're right-wing or left-wing or whatever, need to have a sort of an identity and try to build an identity. I think that's more easy today to build an identity and use different type of media outlets to actually have people feel belonging to that type of identity and be part of the process of identity. And you still see expressions of clothing as an important part of that identity. But I also would say that a lot of the identity building is in the type of interactive communications between potential supporters and the organizations themselves. And I think it's... I don't know if it's naive to say that it's easier to engage in these processes today for extremist organizations, but the technology has really, at the same time as the technology has really helped us in our everyday life, it's at the same time it also helps extremist organizations to reach their aims and to achieve their purposes of their operations. And one part and one aspect of that is to form an identity, and that goes beyond clothing now, but it's still an important part of it, I think. I mean, the media representation of extremist organization, if we look at ISIS, for instance, currently, we as in the Western mainstream media are representing ISIS in the exact way that they want us to represent them. The type of pictures, the type of stories, everything plays in their hands. And I think that's interesting, because that wasn't possible before these type of technological developments we have seen before. So, I think it's interesting. Technology plays a vital part.
In what way? Could you elaborate on what you mean when you say that playing into people's hands? What kind of representational strategies are you talking about?
It's hard to talk about ISIS, and because I don't want to talk and say that they are so good and they are so skillful, but they are quite skillful in how they use technology and their strategies to reach and target audiences. One of those strategies is to try to, let's call it news management, almost like to control their image in Western media representations. One specific example: we can't really send photographers or journalists to Syria and Iraq right now and to take pictures because it's too dangerous. There are exceptions, which means that the pictures our mainstream media gets are often propaganda pictures from them because they are very accessible. It's very easy to integrate them in a news story about them. So that also helps, and it's sometimes I guess it's unaware that we are representing them in a way that they want us to do, or us as in mainstream media. But it is an important factor, and it's definitely a very significant part of ISIS strategy to be perceived as a specific type of group for different audiences. They want the West to be scared. They want the locals to feel more engaged. I mean, there are different type of but they manage to do that in to some extent at least. And I think that's really interesting. You haven't seen that before. Hmm. I can't remember any group that have done like that.
Going back to technology just a little bit, to what extent do you think the shift in the use of digital platforms is also connected to demographic and age group specifically?
It's very important. We saw that also. You can mirror that, reflect that in history with right wing extremism during the 1980s, before the internet really came through, or the personal computer into our homes. The 1980s right wing extremists were quite middle aged, often men. But in the 1990s, a younger generation became the neo-Nazi movement, speaking for white supremacy, using the new technology. And I see similar aspects today of generational. I mean, how groups like ISIS or Boko Haram or anyone who uses social media in a way to recruit members, they target mainly a younger audience below 25. Because these groups are millenarian, many of them, which means that they also seek to build some sort of future. The future is really important for them because in their worldview, they are the ones that will survive the apocalyptic battle of society. So they need a younger generation to take their ideology further. So they target very specifically a younger generation. And social media. And when we say social media, that includes communication apps like Keek or Snapchat or stuff like that, that a very young generation uses on a daily basis. That's a very important part. And then you have social media like YouTube and other similar networks where you just put up videos. But to actually reach people, there's an important combination of online messaging through these type of mobile apps with the physical encounter of recruiters on location in different European countries. So there's a combination of offline and online in the recruitment process that is really important if we want to understand how they recruit. It's not as simple as to say that they just use social media. It doesn't work like that.
Right. And that's, that's interesting because most of us would think that from the way you're describing it, that it's actually quite easy to access this content. But are you saying that you have to somehow be guided there through an offline interaction that then becomes online?
I think it's the other way around. You start in the online communication, establishing some sort of trust, and then the offline recruiter meets you and in different way, logistically, practically help you to actually travel to Iraq and Syria. So it goes from, I would say, online to offline, and then to execute some sort of action.
Let's talk a little bit about authenticity as it relates to the kind of propaganda that various groups use. Sometimes, you know, you can see things online and you think, oh, that's not real, because the line between fiction and reality is so much blurred, especially because more and more the films that we watch are so hyper-realistic. So, I mean, how important is authenticity in this whole discussion in terms of the kinds of content that's produced and how people receive it?
Authenticity is central, not only for me as a researcher. We have all these issues of authenticity, but also in terms of public perception of the group, I would say. And in my work, having studied this for over a year now, and a lot of propaganda material, the authenticity is the hardest thing, or the hardest outlet to validate, is the videos, because there are a lot of analog and traditional media that is quite obvious, and also comes out of public channels. But authenticity, when it comes to their videos and that type of material, there is a sort of that we rely on their official outlets, plus the fact that ISIS is very skillful in the visual imagery, which is very specific if you compare them with other groups. I mean, there is I can rely quite a lot on my knowledge about how other groups communicate to validate also that this is an ISIS production. So, but there is always an uncertainty about it. But I think that is actually what we have. I don't see any other way to validate it rather than trying to understand the wider context in which they are produced. So that's important for me as a researcher. And I also, of course, for the public perception, meaning that how people perceive this group, there is a sense of professionalism in a lot of their stuff and their material, which I guess appeals to our sense of feeling trust and feeling that this is something that we had never seen before, an originality. There are certain dimensions there that I think is very important. I know that ISIS, they focus a lot on building a very strong authenticity in terms of their identity building, to make that connotation for people that this is for real. This is no joke. This is no little group like lost in space. They are the real deal. I think that's very important for them.
But at the same time, this also touches another issue, which is public opinion. And what you describe suggests that pretty much all videos that certainly come out of the Islamic world are considered to be in one way or another authentic. But of course, all documents can be falsified for so many different reasons. So I'm wondering why it is also from a public opinion perspective that we believe what we see, particularly in that part of the world. But then in other contexts, it may be that we may question authenticity.
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that not only ISIS, but the region itself and the subject itself and the ongoing battle between the Middle Eastern and Islamist extremism in the Western world, it's very rooted in us that we have a specific way to approach and understand this. When a group like ISIS comes along, that becomes even more obvious, I would say, that we have learned for decades to think about this region and think about extremism in a certain way, mainly due to the representation in Western media, that makes it really hard for us to change that cognitive schemata of our understanding for these groups. So I think it has a historical and is a very long process of socialization into a subject which we are quite unaware of. I think that would be the best answer I can give there, because I think it's a very problematic aspect, or I mean, it's hard, it's a complex issue why we feel like this. But I think it has to do with how we have been taught to think about this type of movements.
Yeah, and it's tied in a way to broader social issues, at least in the West, which are to do with intercultural interaction and racism and intolerance. So, and I mean, it's interesting thinking about this being the sort of area that young people are really involved in, because one thing all young people from whatever generation are great at is appropriation and the kind of, you know, playing with language and using humor. So it would not surprise me if humor was also part of this dialogue around, you know, oh, this is an IS video, for example, or this is, you know. So this is why I'm sort of probing you on authentication, because we have these immediate implicit biases based on this long history that you've described. But they may also be skewing our perception of how small or big or whatever the problem really is.
I think it does. I think it does. I think it's an important aspect of trying to understand our perception of groups like this. And also, these groups, they play on that perception. They are aware of that perception. So they use the means in a very strategic way to try to reach audiences with different purposes by playing on that history.
So you speak Arabic?
I speak a little, but I read and understand. Yeah, I'm trying my best.
Because I wanted to ask you a question that is
not
about
in Arabic.
Language. Not in Arabic, okay. I don't. A question about language and this idea of translation. Because obviously as a researcher, you're a few steps removed from the content and its uses and its meanings to a certain extent. How do you study this as a researcher with the language as a tool, but how do you gain access?
There are different processes. When I started, I could do quite fine by knowing English, because a lot of their material was available on English websites and web forums. As time went by and a lot of corporations started to shut down and try to censor this material, it moved over to more Arabic forums and websites. And that's when I realized that I really needed to know at least some Arabic to be guided into where I can find the material and find... I mean, I study not only the official material, but also the what I call sociological propaganda, where people... create stuff and talk about stuff after it has been released, and their supporters, how they interact with the material. So I had to learn Arabic to actually gain the necessary knowledge to go in depth. Of course, I could have taken five of the most known videos of Western journalists being executed, but I was not interested in only that. I wanted to dig in deeper. And then I at least in my opinion, you need to know some Arabic to be able to do that, because a lot of the productions today are also in Arabic. So, I started learning Arabic. I studied for a year now, and it has helped a lot. But there is this level of access, and also to learn where to look for stuff, where to find it. We have open websites like LiveLeak and stuff, who in the beginning started to post these material, but then started to censor them and not show them anymore. So it has shifted, but I find most of the material on Arabic websites.
I mean, this whole discussion kind of puts one on the edge of one's seat, as it were, because it's a territory that most of us aren't very well versed in. I mean, when we're using our email and internet on a daily basis. How do you gain access to this material? Do you worry about issues to do with privacy and surveillance, whether it's from the state or from groups themselves?
I didn't even reflect on that in the beginning. But now in the last few weeks and months, I actually started to think a lot more on it. And it has really affected me to the sense that... I hope at least that a lot of it is paranoia, but it's a way of thinking and protecting oneself, because every move I make, if I download one of the apps that they are using, for instance, which I have done, and I create a username just to follow conversations, I realized that okay, so now my username is public here. What is also public, if my username is public, my IP, where I set, my location. I started to think about it more and more when I got more into the actual material. And also on open networks like Twitter, where accounts are starting to following me, accounts with very close connection to ISIS, in the sense that they use their logotype if I look the material they are spreading. Yeah, it really started to affect me, that I started to think about stuff that I say, stuff that I write. So, yeah, I worry about those things. I do. Not to the extent that I would quit today and don't ever touch this material again, but I do get worried. I do. And I think it's important, not least for me, to recognize that I actually feel more exposed than I was before. And I think I have been unaware of the process that has led me to this, but now I suddenly feel really exposed, because now I'm in the middle of it and I can't really get away from it. It's hard to describe, but yeah, I do worry about these things.
It must be an interesting learning space, that space of exposure, yeah. Especially to such contested material. And I mean, is there anything that you could maybe kind of give back to us as the regular internet user as a learning curve that might help the way we navigate the internet more broadly?
I'm not sure what that advice would be. I would never say that don't use technology, be afraid of using technology. That would never happen. I think there are it's too important to be afraid of that. But if we express, we have a political climate that if we express certain opinions and if we touch upon certain subjects, we must be aware of that there are consequences, in the sense that if you write a debate article, you will always get criticism from the other side. But and this type is just different, that you feel, or I feel, somewhat surveilled. It doesn't really matter what measures I take. I still feel surveilled because I have got into a subject. And being aware of that you might be surveilled, that also changes our thinking. You don't have to read Foucault to know that. But there is a sense of, yeah, that you are surveilled. And I think we need to maybe work on strategies to handle that, because we will always be surveilled. Technology functions like that. So yeah, talk about these issues and develop strategies to handle it rather than shutting internet down.
Moving slightly to the left of the internet and back into the other sort of modes of representation that some extremist groups use. There are, you know, magazines such as The Beacon Inspire with regards to IS, but also other publications from different groups. I mean, what is the nature of that kind of material? What is that analog material doing that the online material isn't?
The analog material, if we take magazines like Dabiq, for instance, they also have newspapers coming out more frequently. But Dabiq is a magazine that comes out once a month, and it has, I think it's 12 or 13 issues now. And that type of material is rarely as violent as the videos and a certain type of imagery that we see in other outlets or social media outlets. The traditional media, or analog media, has a more a wider array of genres being covered. Everything from information on how military operations are going, how schools are doing, how the financial situation looks like. They also have, they praise those fighters who have died in battle. They have memorial stories on them, for instance, treating them like heroes. They have advice for medical issues. And I mean, there is an amazing array of subjects being covered in the analog media. I mean, every issue of this magazine is about 80 to 90 pages long, high production value, in sense of it's a very glossy magazine with very well composed images and stories and text. And also there's a lot of religion being stream through this type of, a lot of quotes from different type of Islamic material, in different ways trying to explain why the Islamic State is functioning, why it is existing, why it is progressing. There's always this religious framework. So the analog media has a wider array of narratives and genres, I would say, than the social media being used, the social media being used more for either scare or to recruit. So I think that would be the main difference. Besides, the Dabiq magazine is published in five languages for every issue. I think it's Arabic, it's Russian, French, English, and one more language, I can't remember. German. So it's five languages. That's a lot of production.
It certainly is. And how does that, does that ever come up against other kinds of material from other groups on the other side, as it were? I mean, like, it, what you're describing is like this massive sort of like pool of subversive information that's running alongside, mainstream media.
It does run alongside mainstream media. I think that people, especially in the West, treat it as some sort of social media anyway, because they download it as a PDF, have it in their computer, and to distribute the magazine is only distributed especially in the region as a actual physical magazine. But yeah, it's a lot of production. I don't think that the general public really are aware of the amount of propaganda material coming out every day from especially ISIS, who has the most frequent production and the most developed media industry and a lot of media wings in different regions now. So it's the amount of material coming out is huge, actually, and it's quite hard to grasp all of it. But it is interesting because it is running beside or next to the mainstream media information. And it's also a way for groups to communicate their, not only as widespread propaganda, but also a lot of the stuff in this magazine is threats about what is to come. So they use it as an outlet to, very specifically, there are screenshots of trailers of movie productions, that they call it, that will come in a few weeks. So it's like a trailer for a big Hollywood blockbuster, and they do in this magazine Dabiq, they do, oh, here are the 10 best video productions of this month from the Islamic State, and they have, it's an extremely developed way of, I don't know, convergence between different media outlets. So they use it for different purposes. But yeah, the amount is huge.
Is there any research? Are you joined by a sort of army of researchers? Is there any research being done, for example, from within the Middle East region or within that kind of philosophical kind of realm, as it were? So people on that side... are they researching their own propaganda, their own image making and production?
I don't know if I've joined an army of research. I haven't found one single researcher in Sweden working with this, from this type of perspective, actually. But there are a lot of studies and research being made from the Middle East region. We as researchers in the West, we seldom read other articles than the English speaking and from American University or UK or whatever. But there are a lot of research taking place in the Middle East on these issues. There has been during the last 2 years, maybe, I would say that there has also been this strong criticism against religious leaders from the Middle East region. Why are they not more explicitly condemning what ISIS is doing and how they are twisting the words of Islam? But actually, a lot of research that has been made from the Middle East has focused on this type of condemnation, because a lot of Arab leaders have actually condemned this in a very specific way. It's just that in the mainstream Western thinking about this, it just doesn't fit. That would make it too complex. But so it's interesting to read the research on how the Arab world actually responded to this, because you don't really see that in the Western academic corpus or the mainstream media, I would say. So yeah, there are research, but not necessarily from ISIS ideological point of view. It's more about how can we counter this with what they call the true Islam. Well, how can we use religion and take back the name of Islam? So it's a different type of research, but it's really interesting actually, and we should take more into our understanding of this subject from those writers.
But it's a challenge because you're doing research that is so incredibly polarizing and hits people in the chest.
Yeah, it is.
Because there's so much violence and pain involved. And because it's sort of surrounded by a climate of fear. I mean, how do you stay relatively balanced in that kind of...
Now you're assuming that I am balanced, right? No, I stay quite balanced because as a human being, I think we force ourselves to get used to stuff that we don't want to get used to. It's the way our mind works. I have found strategies and learned strategies to handle the type of violence that I am exposed to. I'm not experiencing it, but I'm exposed to it. And I can understand why people. I talk to friends or acquaintances who don't even want to talk about ISIS or whatever they are doing because they are too scared in the sense that they really can't identify anything or feel some sort of closeness to this. So there is a sense of fear surrounding the topic, and I think it's a problem that I wouldn't say very few people, but people in general maybe have a hard time to talk about these issues, because if we don't talk about these issues, we can't learn about these issues. And my job as a researcher and my aim with doing research on ISIS stuff is to actually improve our understanding for something, not like forgive what they are doing, but to understand why they are doing specifically and how they are doing it, so we better can cope with the issues of extremist organizations in different ways trying to ideologically affect and persuade people to join them. So yeah, there is a sense of fear, but I think I have during this time learned to handle that type of fear. Because I feel fear as well, but it's a different fear, I think. It is not based on that I don't know a lot of stuff, because I feel that I actually know a lot of stuff right now. But it's a different type of fear of human endeavors and human behavior that it's really striking when I think about it, yeah.
And I wonder if that fear of human endeavors and human behavior is one of the reasons why it's so difficult for people to... never mind talk about it, but just approach the subject, because this is a kind of extreme or end result of other interactions and processes and abuses of power that are unfinished and unresolved.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely the unresolved, which I also think actually scares people. And it is a fear that is rooted within us, I think.
So... overall, what have you learnt over your journey of research that do you feel really stands out to you and you think, oh, okay, I didn't know this before, but I know this now?
Except from all the particular knowledge about ISIS and extremism in this region, I think I have learned a lot about, and I'm still learning a lot about, how the region works and in what type of political and social conditions that extremism may grow. And I think that is a discussion that we really need to have, not only on the political agenda in European countries, but in general, to understand that if we create societies where there is polarization, there will always be polarization, but if we create them by basing our assumption of people that we are very, very different from each other, and creating societies where people feel alienated, that's when extremism has a chance to actually and we connected to technology, to use the technology that we saw with democratic purposes developed in the West, and extremist organizations use the same technology in these societies where people feel alienated and they don't feel belonging. So they use social media to get a sense of belonging and identity and hope for something, and make that as an important tool to reach people, to join them. I've learned that the political and social climate is really important to understand how extremist organizations group, actually communicate, and how they operate. That is one important aspect. And I also learned that on a more personal level, I would say that when I started, and I still am, but I started as an atheist, and I didn't really have a relation to religion. I am still an atheist, but now I feel I have a relation to religion. I have an understanding of religion. That doesn't mean that what ISIS and their view of religion is has anything to do with my understanding of it. It's just that it is so paradoxical to see in, you can see it in a lot of the material and propaganda they are putting out there, that they are worshipping, the victim and the perpetrator are worshipping the same God. They have the same faith, but they are very different approaches to it. And it's strikingly paradoxical and strange to work and analyze with this type of material, where that type of devotion to a religion happens at the exact same second when a perpetrator hurts a victim, and they are at the same second doing what they are doing. One is dying, one is killing. They're doing what they do because with a faith to a specific religion. And that paradox is very, I think it really strikes me when I have looked at this. And I felt really, I don't know, it's just respect for people. It's a respect for religion, that people in their last seconds of life devote themselves to a God and a belief that everything will be okay, even if they know what awaits them. That I have learned. And I think that have made me or developed some sort of respect for human beings and for religions that I had no idea I would ever think about when I started it. So no matter the gruesomeness or the atrocities, there is a sense of respect for people, for human life, and for people, religious people, that I have learned. I guess that has developed me as a person as well.
Thank you, Mikkel. That's great.
Thank you.
Thanks.